Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
I'm rolling down the Sunset Highway. I'm rolling down the Sunset Highway.
From the studios of WNYC, New York Public Radio, welcome to Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and my guest on this special Facebook Live edition of our program is the multiple Grammy-winning Americana artist, Steve Earle. Steve is many things, an author, an actor, an activist. He's also a public radio favorite. We're always glad to have him here with us in the studio, this time with a rockin' new album in tow. It's called So You Wanna Be an Outlaw, done with his band, The Dukes. Today, it's Steve Earle solo here in our studio. He's going to play a few of those songs, beginning with this one called Looking for a Woman.
Early in the morning, I'm out of my bed. Hangover ringing like a hammer in my head. I can't rest no matter what I do, 'cause I'm looking for a woman won't do me like you. Well, I've been a 10 down 10 to looking for a woman won't do me like you. East Coast, West Coast, Timbuktu, looking for a woman won't do me like you. Heartbreak Hotel, Blue Bayou, looking for a woman won't do me like you. Just can't shake these lovesick blues, looking for a woman won't do me like you. Oh, I thought of my Melissa, I thought of my Sue. Oh, I thought of my sister, but you mean it ain't you. Like Carolina Rose will never do, 'cause I'm looking for a woman won't do me like you. Well, I've been a 10 down 10 too, looking for a woman won't do me like you. East Coast, West Coast, Timbuktu, looking for a woman won't do me like you. Heartbreak Hotel, Blue Bayou, like you. Just can't shake these lovesick blues, looking for a woman won't do me like you. Oh, I'm looking for a woman won't do me like you. Looking for a woman won't do me like you. I'm looking for a woman won't do me like you.
Steve Earle with the song Looking for a Woman. That's the title, although there are titles strewn throughout the lyrics of that song.
Yeah, there's that one verse, there definitely are.
Yeah. Yeah. So You Wanna Be an Outlaw, the name of the new record.
Yeah.
You have many different types of music that you've done over the years, but is that your kind of musical lineage?
It is, without a doubt. And I think it's one thing I sort of missed about my history, because it took me so long to get a record deal. It was 1986 by the time Guitar Town came out. And I'd been in Nashville since November 1974. So I very much got there at the height of what people refer to as the outlaw thing. And part of this was wanting to reconnect to that. You know, people say, well, is this back to Guitar Town? It's more like a prequel, maybe, but it's also, you know, informed by everything I've done since. I'm a way better singer and a way better guitar player than I was when I made Guitar Town. So, you know, I'm in the back pickup of a Fender Telecaster, this almost the whole record, you know, and I just – Telecasters are kind of adult guitars, you know. They're not very forgiving. It's one of those things.
And when you say the back pickup, for folks who are not guitarists.
It's the treble position pickup. You know, there's two pickups on most of those little, they're microphones, essentially. They're magnets that pick up the sound that come from an electric guitar. There's one in what they call the neck position and one they call the bridge position. The bridge position is closer to the bridge that holds the strings at the back. And if you move your pick back towards the bridge, you get a higher, more trebly sound back there. That's just because the strings are tighter there. There's more high overtones that come off of it. So you get this naturally trebly tone from if you use the back pickup on a Fender Telecaster especially.
Right, and the one up closer to the neck is a more rounded, mellower.
More rounded, lower, and I use that pickup a lot for a lot of things, I just not on this record.
Yeah, right. So when you say outlaw country, I mean, we're talking people like the late Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, who was on this record.
Billy Joe Shaver would fit in. Johnny Cash was kind of the original outlaw because people talk about it like it was about the lifestyle. And the fact is, you know, George Jones wasn't going to the liquor store at 3:30 in the morning on the lawnmower. He, you know,
he was just singing about it.
There weren't any liquor stores open. And so there were drugs and all sorts of other stuff going on in Nashville with mainstream country artists. That's not what it was about. What it was about was artistic freedom. And it really starts with Doug Somm, who was my local hometown rock and roll hero because I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. Doug Somm had the band called the Sir Douglas Quintet in the 60s. And he moved back from California in 1971 and moved to San Antonio first, which is where he was from. In fact, his kids went to the same high school that I went to, and I followed his daughter home one time just so I could meet him, you know, and I met Doug Somm in his driveway, just, you know, just walked up to him and introduced myself as he was walking to his car. After that, he figured out he was too weird to live in San Antonio anymore, and he moved to Austin, and he got a place out by this roadhouse called Soap Creek Saloon. He lived really near it, and he started playing there on a regular basis, doing sort of a residency there. And Bob Dylan came and stayed with him when he was in that house. He signed with Atlantic Records. He made the Doug Somm and Friends record. And Jerry Wexler had signed him. And when they were making that record and Wexler was being turned on to all these musicians from that region that Doug worked with, he said, well, if you want to sign, you know, progressive country singer, songwriter, then you need to sign Willie Nelson. And Willie had just moved back to Texas and started playing Flores Country Store and some traditional country venues, but thanks to Doug, he started playing at Armadillo World Headquarters, and Jerry Wexler signed him, and he made Shotgun Willie first, and then Phases and Stages, and those weren't widely heard records around the country, but where I was in Texas, everybody had them, and it was kind of a big deal. It was the beginning of something.
So you made this record in Austin.
I did. It was friends there that have a recording studio. It's actually Lisa Fletcher and Freddie Fletcher have a studio called Arlen. Freddie's Willie Nelson's nephew. I've known him for a long time. My bass player, Kelly Looney, and Freddie were Billy Joe Shaver's rhythm section when they were teenagers in the first real band that Billy Joe had. You know, it was just a lot of things led to it. It was the kind of record that it was, and my grandkids are in Austin as well, so it gave me a little extended period of time to be around them that I hadn't ever had since either one of them had been on the planet. So that was kind of the final deciding factor to record there.
Right. But it certainly was an appropriate location given this kind of...
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's funny because Waylon never recorded in Austin. He moved to Nashville around the time that Willie moved to Texas. By the time I got there, Willie was holding down the fort in Austin and Waylon was holding down the fort in Nashville, and all hell had broken loose.
But, you know, Merle Haggard had taken this kind of journey, you know, where he became considered part of the outlaw.
Yeah.
He was... You know, you think of those early songs, you know, Okie from Muskogee and that sort of thing. For him, that was a journey.
It was, but, you know, it's funny because I think I wanted to hate Merle Haggard really bad because I had long hair and I felt like that song was being mean to me. But I also knew how good he was, and it was hard for me to ignore him. You know, he did evolve, and it wasn't just about smoking pot. It was a lot of things, but he was lending a voice to people that he felt like were his audience and speaking to people that took the government's word for it that we had a reason for being in Vietnam. And these were working people. And when they saw people they considered to be privileged people, that because they were in college weren't going to get drafted and weren't going to go anyway, they took it personally. And, you know, it's like... the whole trauma of Vietnam is still, that's what Copperhead Road was about. And that's what, you know, when I made that record in the 80s, and that's what Platoon was about. It took 10 years for the post-Vietnam art to start getting made because it was traumatic for everybody, no matter who you were. It was unprecedented. You know, it was about trying to face up to who we are. Mm-hmm. You know, why are we in this country? And what we were told is that we were keeping communism from spreading there because it would be, you know, in Missouri if we didn't stop it in Vietnam, which didn't make any sense. But some people really, truly believed it just because people that they trusted told them that it was true.
So watching, you know, Merle Haggard's kind of political journey and musical journey was a very interesting thing.
Right.
And, you know, so he ends up as part of this kind of quote unquote outlaw country scene. And you've made this record that's kind of looking back at that. Is this a political record somehow?
No, it's just maybe the most unpolitical record I've ever made. It's a very personal record, but I've made personal records before.
Yeah.
We recorded this record in December, so the election had happened. So I thought Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States. I was a Bernie guy to the end. Hillary, you know, I voted for her, but it was not my idea of the perfect candidate or even anything close to it. You know, I went on stage that night, election night in Canada, assuming that I was going to come off and Hillary Clinton was going to be president of the United States. And at least I knew what that was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing songs for a record that was pretty personal, and I figured, well, we'll see what happens when it comes time to make the next record, but I can do this now. And then it happened, and the sessions started in December, and I thought about writing some different songs and making the record different than it is. And I just decided, you know what? I wrote this record to be a certain thing. I like what it is, and I like the songs a lot. I don't want them to get lost. So I'm going to make this record and put it out. And I have this really great country rock band now. And,
the Dukes,
It's evolved into this sort of, you know, this zenith. And the next record probably be just as country as this one and way more political. You can pretty much count on it.
Well, a lot of these songs, you know, they are about relationships and, you know, they're kind of personal character studies and stuff. You want to play the title track for us?
Yeah, this is like when I knew what the record was going to be, I wrote this almost immediately. I'd written a couple of songs. I wrote Looking for a Woman, and I wrote If Mama Could Have Seen Me. Actually, both were written by commission from first T-Bone Burnett and then Buddy Miller when they were the musical directors of the TV show Nashville.
Yeah.
So I wrote both of them for the TV series, and then I realized I had these two songs that were kind of the same thing, and then I realized I'd been listening to Honky Tonk Heroes a lot. This Waylon Jennings record is one of my favorite records. And so when I wrote this, I just, it was all the whole idea of rehabilitating the term outlaw, and I immediately thought in terms of Willie Nelson. I wrote the second verse for Willie to sing, and I was honored that he did. So.
Wanna be an outlaw, buddy, listen to me. Living on the highway ain't everything it's supposed to be. Everybody reckons that they wanna be free. Ain't nobody wants to be alone. Running down the alley at a quarter to three. Hollering for Sally, honey, what you trying to do to me? She said, go to hell, I'm going back to Tennessee. I said, Angel, you can never go. Never go home. Never go home. If you wanna be an outlaw, you can never go home. So you wanna be an outlaw, better listen up, kid. Steal $1 million and you had to keep it hid. Ain't no place to spend it in the desert if you did. Can't take it with you when you go. Something always went for you up around a bend. Everything that goes around come back around again. Can't trust anybody, not a lover or a friend. Mama, maybe then you never know. Never do know. Never do know. If you wanna be an outlaw, then you never do know. Thank you. Better not pout, better not cry. Won't nobody give a damn about you when you die, but the devil when it comes for his due. If you're standing at the crosses, don't you try to flag a ride. Don't you get down on your knees, don't you know it's already been tried. Hate to tell you, but the only upside is sing a devil out of the blues. Singing the blues, keep on singing the blues. Oh, sing the soul, sing wanna be an outlaw blues. Hey,
Steve Earle, solo here in the Soundcheck studio, title track of the new album called So You Wanna Be an Outlaw. He'll be at the Iridium with David Simons. That'll be a taping for PBS, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, David and I have this history because he was the guy that decided, he actually hired me because I wasn't an actor to play a part in The Wire. You know, then he got me there and figured out that I had a theater company and all that stuff. I don't know. He wants to be an actor. But we shot the first thing. He said, that was great. And I just, whatever you didn't take acting lessons. And so we did, you know, I was in The Wire, you know, that first season. And then they brought my character back at the end of season four to set it up for season five. And I was in a lot of season five. And then I was in Treme as well, which was David's show about post-Katrina New Orleans. Right. And that was a blast.
You're also, you do this annual camp, Camp Copperhead.
Yep.
Upstate New York, a little bit west of Woodstock.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, like old school dirty dancing Catskills out there. It's in Big Indian, and it's cell phones don't work in there, in this holler. And it's a place called Full Moon Camp. There are a lot of music camps there. Richard Thompson does one there. I do one. And this is the fourth year. Dar Williams will be there, and Jackie Green helping me out this year. And Commie Lyle, really great trumpet player and singer and songwriter, who I've known for a long time. She's married to Joey Spampinato, you know, who was the bass player in NRBQ for years and years. And she's coming to help out, too.
And it's kind of like a songwriting course.
It is. I teach a master course in the mornings. Beginning about 9:30 or so after breakfast, and it goes, we break for lunch, and I go in about another hour in the afternoon, and then me and John Henry head for the pool, and then the other teachers take over and take people into smaller groups to teach other things. We have a guitar teacher, too. You know, it's Henry Nelson, who's been with us from the beginning, is a great teacher.
So as someone who teaches songwriting as a curriculum over a kind of an intensive period, you know, it's clearly something that you've had to think about other than just, this is something I do intuitively. I mean, you've needed to,
yeah, no, I mean, I had good teachers, and some of them taught and wrote intuitively, and some of them were a little more methodical about it. And one of the people that was more methodical about it was Guy Clark. And, you know, Towns Van Zandt, who I met first, he would give me a book and tell me to go read it. You know, it was that kind of stuff. Guy did that kind of stuff, too, but he also would show me how he laid out words on a page, because this is, I write everything digitally now because it works best for me because my handwriting is illegible. But Guy wrote to, he passed away last year, and he wrote to the bitter end on, you know, big, he always said, I write with a pencil with a big eraser. And it's about rewriting and refining. I learned that from him. And he was a workman at everything he did. He built guitars and he built songs, and he was really, really good at it.
Well, now here's why I ask about the, you know, examining the process of songwriting, because you do so much different kinds of writing.
Right.
You know, I mean, you've written a novel, you've written, what was this Samara project?
Well, I didn't write that. I wrote music for that. Samara is the new play by Richard Maxwell, which just closed a couple of weeks ago. Soho Rep, which is your neighbor's not far from here.
Right, right.
Normally, they perform in a place called Walker Space, which they kind of temporarily lost. I'm glad to say they've gotten it back. But we performed Samara in Hell's Kitchen in a theater complex that the city owns there. And it was a trip because Richard's kind of the experimental playwright. Sarah Benson directed it. I was brought in to do music for it, which I wrote a score for Eulen pipes and percussion, which is like, leave it to me to write a score for an instrument about 50 people in the world play. But there's a couple of good pipers in New York, so I had a couple of people I could work with. And it's Ivan Goff who was available, and he went through the whole workshopping process. And and great piper, and it's that's my favorite. I spent a lot of time, you know, with Irish music, and the pipes are my favorite instrument and the music anyway. So, but then, you know, we workshopped this for 3 years. It takes a long time to stage a play, and yeah. I have other theater projects I'm involved in, but this went on for 3 years. And at one of the workshops, they said, well, we don't have a stage manager for this workshop, so why don't you read the stage directions? And I'd always known the stage directions, to some degree, were going to have to be performed, because it's sort of like the stage manager in our town. The stage directions are poetic, and they're a narration as much as they are anything else. At the end, that narration and light and form sort of take over, and you know, it was a trip, because I'd never actually done anything as an actor on stage before, and it was scary, and I learned a lot. I learned more than probably anything I've done in a long, long time. So,
and that writing process for the pipes and the percussion, that probably is a different kind of writing yet again.
Yeah, it was. I wrote one song. I wrote I'm really proud of a lullaby. It's a lullaby for a mother to sing to her dead son, basically, because she finds him by the side of the road in the play. The rest of it is based on a jig that I wrote. And the way that I wrote it, because I don't play pipes, and you know, I could probably write a jig on mandolin, and I've done, you know, stuff like that. But I ended up writing it, you know, in software on an electronic keyboard and using a pipe patch, mm-hmm. you know, so it would have a rough idea what it was going to sound like when it went to the instruments that it was going to. And then the percussion was basically the guts out of a piano played with timpani mallets and other things that we whacked it with, you know, playing it as the whole harp inside of a piano as a percussion instrument. It was sitting upright on the floor, and the percussionist sat on the floor as she played it. And I got that from a production of Faustus I was involved in high school. We did that for sound effects in that production. And that was my drama teacher, Vernon Carroll's idea. I took it a little step further, because what this percussion was actually playing music on it, and it's a lot trickier. And I couldn't have done it myself, but I could kind of make it up and get her pointed in the right direction.
Nice. So a kind of a different writing process, and then there's, you know, you do write prose, you know, fiction, nonfiction.
Right.
Is it all coming from the same creative spot?
Yeah, I mean, everything informs everything else. I'm a songwriter. I'm working on a musical. I finally surrendered to that. When I first got here, I thought I wanted to write straight plays. I didn't want anything to do with musical theater. Probably a lot of that was fear. But when I wrote Washington Square Serenade, I really had it in the back of my mind that that was a musical. And I chickened out. And I've decided to unchicken out, and I've started. I'm talking to a company in town about developing Washington Square Serenade into a musical, and probably writing the book myself. We'll see. I've seen a lot of great musicals the last few years that changed my mind about it. You know, Hamilton's Everything is cracked up to be. Dear Evan Hansen is stunning. The Great Comet is great. There's just a lot of great, you know, musical theater that is art going on in New York City right now.
And so you'll be diving into that pool at some point.
Look, people in musical theater, it's not lost on them that we're coming from a dying record business like rats from a sinking ship. And they resent it, and I completely and totally understand that. So I've been here 12 years, and I came here to breathe the same air as Tony Kushner as much as anything else. And so I can see theater, and so I can make theater. And it's one of the reasons I moved to New York.
Steve Martin and Edie Brickell did it, you know, and they to get a show on Broadway. I mean, your off-Broadway thing you said took 3 years.
Yeah,
so getting something on Broadway is a major commitment of time and effort.
Yeah, it is. It's tough, and I've only got so much time left. You know, it's one of those. It's a whole other career, something to think about. But I've seen some exciting things that inspired me to want to do it recently. So.
All right.
Hadestown, that was another one at at New York Theater Workshop, and that's
is that Aeneas Mitchell?
Aeneas Mitchell, yeah. That. I saw it 3 times, actually.
Yeah. We're speaking with Steve Earle. His latest record is called So You Want to Be an Outlaw. One of my favorite tracks on the record comes towards the end, and most of the record is you and the Dukes, and the Dukes are very much in evidence. But on this song, it almost sounds like it, you know, was meant to be played solo to begin with.
Well, it's just, you know, the way I've played it solo quite a bit. I mean, I wrote it. We lost Guy Clark last year, like I said, and there was a wake in Nashville, and then some of us got on a tour bus and took his ashes to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And don't ever say out loud what you want done with yourself when you're gone around Terry Allen, because he'll accommodate you. And Guy's there waiting to be installed in a bronze that Terry is making, because that's Terry's day job, is he's a visual artist. And So we went, me, Rodney Crowell, and Sean Camp, and Jim McGuire, Tamara Saviano. We took Guy's Ashes to Santa Fe, and Lyle Lovett, Emmylou Harris, Robert Earl Keen, Joe Ely, a bunch of other folks showed up there. And we had another wake there, and we played a lot of songs, and we cried a lot. And then when I got home, I wrote this. Goodbye, Michelangelo. Ain't no trouble where you go. Ain't no pain to burn you blind. Just enough to draw a line. Goodbye, Maestro Fedderwell. Gone to heaven, been to hell. Maybe just New Mexico. Goodbye, Michelangelo. Farewell, my captain, adios. Sail upon the sea of ghosts. Chase the white whale to the end. Bring the story back again. I'm bound to follow you someday. You have always shown the way. So we knew where we had to go. Goodbye, Michelangelo. Like it did before, saying forever is just goodbye till it comes my time. I won't have to travel blind. Taught me everything I know. Goodbye, Michelangelo.
A tribute to the late Guy Clark from Steve Earle. It's called Goodbye, Michelangelo, and you'll find it on his new record called So You Wanna Be an Outlaw. So, touring?
The first show in the area, I think, is probably going to be with Los Lobos, like after Labor Day in Tarrytown. But we'll come in. The show in New York City will end up being the benefit for the Keswell School, my son's school. So, but we'll bring the tour show in for that, and we'll have special guests and... we'll be at the City Winery one night and then, you know, the Town Hall the next night like we always are.
As you have in the past.
Yeah.
And as you've done in the past, some of the songs on this new record refer to older songs. You know, we talked before about, you know, Looking for a Woman with the titles of various songs sort of woven into it. There's a song called Fixin' to Die on the new record. Is that meant to be kind of an echo of Led Zeppelin's version of When the Levee Breaks?
Well, yeah. I mean, musically, yeah, absolutely. But I figure that's fair game, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's one of those deals. Musically, it's The Levee Breaks, and, you know, thematically, it's Hey Joe and Long Black Veil. And you used to be able to write songs about killing people, and you can't really do it in country music anymore.
Well, that's real outlaw country, isn't
it? Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Steve, always a pleasure to have you with us. We're going to end with a little bit of Fixin' to Die from the new record. Congratulations. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Steve Earle, my guest. This is Soundcheck.
Now follow the car to the hill. I follow the car to the hill. I follow the car to the hill. I follow the car to the hill.
That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Follow us at Soundcheck on Twitter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Instagram at Soundcheck Radio. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Light production work provided by the New Sound staff, Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us. Now,